Practical Economics for New Testament Christians was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 13, 2009 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the questions were inaudible. It is hoped that the presenter's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
We don't have a whole lot of time, so all I can really hope to do is not kind of exhaustively look at all these passages, but orient you to these passages. And particularly what I want to focus on and concentrate on is what are not the implications, I think, of these passages, because all of these passages have been used one way or the other by somebody from one side of the political spectrum or the other side of the political spectrum to advocate a certain political philosophy or a certain orientation toward politics or a certain orientation toward economics or whatever, and they've become the proof text for their particular perspective and their particular point of view. And in every case here, I think, well, that's true of only three of these. The other one is just interesting, but in three cases, I'm going to argue that they don't say what they are standardly or typically taken to say, I believe. So in order to do that, all I can really hope to do is to orient you toward looking at the passage in a particular way so that in the context of that orientation, you can see how they have been misapplied. And that's all I can really hope to accomplish in the half hour that we have. So let's start with Acts 2 to begin with. Acts 2, of course, is where they are selling their possessions and sharing with one another, eating daily, house to house, and basically taking care of each other. An incredible picture of generosity and mutual care and mutual love. No question about that. That's indisputable. The issue is this the model for how believers, true disciples of Jesus, should structure their life economically? That's what some people would argue, is that we need to emulate the original followers of Jesus in their economics, in their social structure, in their political structure, and that we should imitate them in that regard. And then some people will argue that we should live communally and construct communes to live together if we're going to be really authentic, original disciples of Jesus. What I'm going to contend is if you want to know what the original economic, social relationships of the original disciples are, don't look to Acts 2, look to the epistles. Because in the epistles, you are dropping in on people as they are living their ordinary daily lives. And nowhere in any of the epistles do you find them living communally. Just not true. That's not the case. We find them living communally in some sense of the word communally. It's not a commune, I will contend. But you find them sharing communally and sharing in common in Acts 2. But in order to understand what's going on, we have to understand the context, the historical context. So what's the story? This happens right on the heels of the day of Pentecost. And that spectacular day of Pentecost, not just any old day of Pentecost, but that day of Pentecost in which it was a watershed event in world history where God poured out his Spirit symbolically to represent a sea change in how he was going to deal with mankind. Mankind had been living in darkness. Jesus was the true light coming into the world to enlighten every man. But even Jesus was not able to bring about the change that was looked for. He told the apostles, "Greater works will you do than I do, because when the Spirit comes, he is going to open the eyes and hearts of men, and they will be receptive to this truth in a way that they are not receptive to this truth in my teaching." Jesus taught the gospel, got crucified. Peter preaches the gospel on the day of Pentecost, and 5,000 people believe. What an incredibly greater work Peter did than Jesus did. And why? Because God had poured out his Spirit to transform the receptivity of the people who were being confronted with the message. So Pentecost happens. This incredible, spectacular event happens. Well, what's the scene? In the Torah, there were, I think it's four, I believe, festivals, all of which are commanded in the Torah itself to be celebrated in Jerusalem. You don't celebrate it in your village. You don't celebrate it anywhere else. You travel to Jerusalem, locate in Jerusalem, and celebrate it there. the day of Pentecost in particular, you're supposed to go to Jerusalem and build a hut and live in a hut. You camp out in Jerusalem and celebrate the day of Pentecost. No, that's not true. That's not Pentecost. Can't remember what you do on Pentecost. That's the day of, that's the Feast of Tabernacles. Sorry. But it is supposed to be done in Jerusalem. The biblical scholar Jeremias argues that Jerusalem, on the days of these festivals, that are these major festivals that are supposed to be celebrated in Jerusalem, would double the population overnight in one of these festivals, because you had people traveling from all over the Roman Empire to Jerusalem to celebrate the particular festival. It became impractical, of course, to keep the covenant literally, to go every year to Jerusalem. So the rabbis had come to interpret the festivals. You could keep the covenant if you did a prescribed ceremony in your own home, wherever you were, on a yearly basis. But if at least once in your lifetime you went to Jerusalem to celebrate the festival, it would be considered that you had kept the covenant. Much like Muslims have to go to Mecca once in their lifetime, the Jews have to go to Jerusalem once in their lifetime to take part in one of the festivals in order to have kept the covenant. Well, that requirement that the rabbis laid on the Jews meant that every festival in Jerusalem, there was this influx of pilgrims from all over the Roman Empire coming to do their once-in-a-lifetime, at least, pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So we know that's the case from the book of Acts itself, because remember in the upper room on the day of Pentecost when the Spirit comes, there's the sound like a mighty rushing wind. There's the tongues of fire dancing over their heads. And the apostles begin to praise God and declare the truth of God in languages that they don't know. And all the people gathered there heard them in their own language. If they were from Libya or Spain or Rome or Bithynia, wherever they were from, they heard them in their native language. The Jews of the dispersion, oftentimes their first language was some Gentile language that was spoken in the region in which they lived. They would also know Greek if it was in the East, and they would probably know a dialect of Hebrew or Aramaic, something that they used in their religious synagogue service. But their first language would be some Gentile language. So here in the Gentile language that is these Jews' first language, they're hearing God praised and the truth proclaimed by these apostles in their native Gentile language. Well, why are there Jews who are hearing it in their own language, which is a Gentile language? Because they're from the diaspora, this dispersion of Jews throughout the whole Roman Empire. What are they doing in Jerusalem? They're pilgrims, having come for the day of Pentecost. Okay, well, put yourself in the position of one of these pilgrims. You started off in Spain. You traveled the length of the Mediterranean Sea to Jerusalem. It took you months, probably. How did you afford it? You saved up for it. You saved up for it for years. You had enough money to travel there and to travel back and to give you the upkeep that you needed, lodging, food, while you were there. But that's all you have. That's the only resources you have, is to get you there and back and to take care of you while you're there for the few days that you're there and you're fulfilling your religious obligation. You don't plan on staying in Jerusalem, but this incredible event happens. You see the miracle. And then day by day, the apostles continue to perform miracles, as the text says, and you are daily in awe of the might and power of God as you see people healed and you see various other supernatural things happening. And you are hearing the apostles teach about the life and teaching of Jesus daily. They're filling you in on this man Jesus and who he was and what he did. Are you going to leave? You're going to just walk away from all this? No, you're absolutely intrigued. You're absolutely fascinated with this thing. So you're going to stay. And then here's someone like Barnabas, who is a native of Jerusalem, who has actually some resources. He has some real estate in Jerusalem. He has a job and a means of maintaining himself. He decides, I don't want these newfound friends who are intrigued by the same thing that I'm intrigued to have to go home or starve. I'm going to sell my field, and I'll take the proceeds of that to help feed these people that are gathered here to understand who Jesus is, so that they can hang in there with us and share in this incredible experience that we're all having together. I liken it to Woodstock. The day of Pentecost was the Woodstock of the first century Christians. It couldn't last. It couldn't maintain itself. It was not a permanent set of social relationships. It wasn't a permanent economic phenomenon. It was a special, unique, amazing event that was just intriguing to them. And as I think Phil mentioned in our group, look how interesting this is, what God is doing. To have them sit there until they hear the account of the gospel, they get up to speed on the teaching of Jesus, the life of Jesus, the death and resurrection of Jesus, all that the apostles saw, were eyewitnesses to, and so on. They get up to speed on all that. Okay, now finally they can go back to their lives, go back to their trade, go back to their home, begin to immerse themselves in their lives again, but they're taking this message with them. And so you have a training ground for those people who are going to spread all over the Roman Empire with the gospel message in hand now, having been trained in this intense seminar experience that they've had for a matter of perhaps months, weeks certainly, and perhaps months. We don't really know how long. Okay, so all that's to say, is this how the original Christians live? Well, for a few weeks, yeah. No one ever pretended that it would be a way that you could permanently structure your lives and your economic and social relationships together with each other. They didn't intend to, they didn't expect to, it wouldn't have been practical, and they didn't see anything particularly moral about those living arrangements. But what you do see that's of abiding value is the generosity. A person like Barnabas being willing to liquidate some significant assets in order to allow a significant number of people to share in this life-changing, history-changing experience together. So the generosity is huge and obviously is something to be emulated by every disciple of Jesus whenever, wherever, in whatever context. I mean, there's no question about that. But is it socialism? Is it communism? No, not even close. It's Woodstock. They're being thrown together by circumstance, by the occasion. Okay, you might have questions about that. Let me go on briefly to issue number two. Matthew 25 is often, that's the one about the sheep and the goats, and how does he divide up the sheep from the goats? He asks them the question on the basis of, did you visit me when I was in prison? Did you give me a cup of cold water to drink? You fed me, you clothed me, and so on. And often that passage is used as a proof text for the priority that is being given to taking care of the material needs of other people. So if we're going to be followers, what's going to be the basis of judgment? Social act. The basis, what's going to separate the sheep from the goats? Did I throw myself into fighting poverty and oppression and meeting the material and physical needs of other people? Did I do that or did I not do that? If I did, I'm a sheep. If I didn't, I'm a goat. Or is it the other way around? Okay. This is a little bit controversial. I don't think, if you look at the passage, if you squint right, you'll think I'm completely wrong here and I'm missing the whole point. But don't squint right. My contention would be if you squint differently, you see that his point is actually very, very different. And the key is realizing the funny way in which he teaches it here. The issue is, did you love me, Jesus says. You loved me in that you did this thing to the least of these, my brethren, right? When did we visit you in prison? When did we feed you? When did we clothe you? You did it when you did it to the least of these, my brethren. Well, if all he wants to do is teach social act, that's a really funny way to talk. And the way a lot of Christians take it is, I think, actually absolutely false. And that is that there's a little bit of Jesus in everybody, and since there's a little bit of Jesus in everyone, you should go out and love Jesus by loving everyone and meeting their needs and so on. Now, it's possible. That doesn't make any sense to me. That can't possibly be what Jesus is teaching. Jesus is not someone who ever taught that there's a little bit of Jesus in everybody. I just think that's contrary to everything that he's teaching. What he's getting at is how you respond to followers of Jesus is tied to, linked to, and correlated to what you think of Jesus. If you love Jesus, you will love his followers. If you reject Jesus, you will reject his followers. So it's a very common theme throughout the whole New Testament, what's called love for the brethren, love for your brother, which is different from love for your neighbor. You love your neighbor simply because it's right and good and godlike to be loving. It has nothing to do with who the neighbor is. Doesn't matter who the neighbor is. You should be loving in order to emulate God. That's why you should be loving. But that's love for your neighbor. Love for your brother is a kind of simpatico. If you're from the depth of your being, from the core of your being, are committed to the same God that I'm committed to serving the same God that I'm committed to honoring the same God that I'm committed to, and your whole life revolves around that, then you and I have a whole lot in common. And that's a deep, deep and profound bond between us. That bond goes deeper than language differences, cultural differences, lifestyle differences, all those other things that kind of alienate us from each other and keep us apart are overcome by the bond of having the very core of my being in common, shared in common with you. Well, Jesus and the apostles are constantly teaching that simpatico, that fellowship, that koinonia that we have with one another should express itself in love for one another. If I have that in common with you, it should elicit from me a desire to show you kindness, show you respect, show you honor, and love you in every sense of the word. That's a different kind of love. I'm not loving simply out of moral duty. I'm loving out of unity. It's Aristotle's friendship now that is driving me. I am your friend because we share this big, huge thing in common. I think that's what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 25. When did I visit you in prison? When did I feed you? And so on. Well, when the disciple of Jesus, the follower of Jesus, was thrown in prison as an act of persecution, and you, out of your regard and honor that you had for them, took care of their material needs. Why were you doing that? Because you love their master. You love them because you love the one that they are following. And that then becomes the criteria for, in the end, who will be judged and who will be rewarded. The one who will be judged is the one who rejects the disciples of Jesus precisely because they follow Jesus. And who's the one who's going to be rewarded? The one who loves the disciples of Jesus precisely because they are disciples of Jesus. Because that followers of Jesus become a litmus test of what my attitude is toward Jesus himself. So it really doesn't, in the end, have a lot to do one way or the other. It's certainly not forbidding it or dissing it on the one hand, but neither is it promoting to the foremost meeting the material needs of people as opposed to anything else that I might do for people. It's one way of loving people. It's an important way of loving people. It's a crucial way of loving people, but it's not the only way of loving people, and it's not the point of the passage. The point of the passage is not to express how you should love, but who you should love. You should love Jesus, and how do you know if you love Jesus? You should love the followers of Jesus. If you don't, you're in trouble. Okay, the third one. Well, let me come back to the third one. Let's look at the fourth one. This is the other one that gets greatly misunderstood, I think, when we talk about government politics and so on. It's the famous passage, well, two of them. Give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God in Matthew 22. And then in Romans 13, submit yourself in all things to the governing authorities for they are from God and so on. Famous passages. Let's look at the Romans 13 one first. You have to be rightly oriented to what Paul is doing or you are going to draw wrong conclusions. Again, we have to understand the historical context. What's the historical context both Jesus and Paul find themselves in? We're dealing with Jews fundamentally, or a Jewish perspective. I mean, in a perspective, even if we're talking about Gentiles, these are Gentiles who've entered into a life informed by the Torah of the Jews. What does the law of the Jews teach? No idolatry. And they learned that lesson. That was the only lesson they learned, but they did learn that lesson well in Babylon. Only one God. You don't worship multiple gods. There's one and only one God, and you need to be absolutely, completely, totally committed to that God and that God alone. So every Jew knows that Yahweh and only Yahweh is the God to worship. Okay, over here in Rome you have Caesar claiming to be God. You're a Jew. How are you going to show any honor and respect to Caesar and not have that be idolatry? This is a false god, a guy claiming to be a god who wants your devotion, your taxes, your duty, your fear, your respect. Everything in you that you have been enculturated into as a Jew rebels at that. No way are we going to give any respect and honor to Caesar whatsoever. He's an unrighteous, heathen, arrogant, pretend god. It would be disrespectful to Yahweh. It would be to disregard my loyalty to Yahweh if I give any deference to Caesar. Well, every Jew in Paul and Jesus' time basically took that perspective. It then became a practical matter of, well, how much can I get away with not honoring Caesar without being an idolater, without being disloyal to my God? On the one hand, you had your typical Pharisee who held their nose and paid their taxes to Caesar. And the whole time that everything in them felt, something felt wrong about that, they somehow were able to justify, well, okay, but I'll pay my taxes to Caesar. Then you have degrees of radicalization on the other end of that. You have the zealots who refused to pay taxes to Caesar as an act of religious commitment to God. They refused to pay taxes to Caesar, and they were consciously and purposely in rebellion against Rome and were constantly involved in one insurrection after another where they were taking up military arms against the armies of Rome to try to overthrow Rome because it was their moral and religious obligation to do so. And then you had the Sicarii, who were basically terrorists of that time, who were named after a little dagger that they would hide in their cloak. They would make their way into a marketplace, stab to death either a Roman or a Jewish collaborator with Rome, and then escape into the crowd and be gone. It was their form of terrorism at the time. And they were doing that as an act of religious obligation to honor Yahweh by opposing the heathen governor. So the question in Romans 13, in the context of we need to offer our whole lives to God as an offering that is of holiness, give a life given over to holiness. Well, what does it mean to be holy? And he has in Romans 12, he has a long list of things that you would do to be holy. When he gets to Romans 13, he realizes, you might have a question in this regard. In order to be holy, do you have to withhold your taxes from Caesar? That would be the knee-jerk response of any Jew. The knee-jerk response is, absolutely, you have to show your loyalty to God by not showing any fear and honor to the Roman emperor. Paul gives a surprising and different answer out of a much more enlightened view. His response is, look, that pretend God Caesar wouldn't be there if our God didn't put him there. And because he wouldn't even be there if our God didn't put him there, we're not showing disrespect to our God by paying him taxes. God can take care of him whenever and however he wants to. In the meantime, we're simply paying taxes to the one who is ultimately subservient to our God, because God put him in that place. Our God is the one who has the authority to put people in and take people out. So God is not so small, God is not so touchy, that he's going to be offended if we show social respect and pay taxes to somebody that he's put there in the first place. God is above all that. Because Paul has a bigger view of God than some of his contemporaries, it gives him the freedom to actually not see it as a failure of holiness if he simply accepts the political status quo that God has put in place. I think that's exactly the answer that Jesus is giving in Matthew 25. Give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, but give unto God that which is God's. He's basically saying, is it a problem to pay taxes to Caesar? Nah, not really. But just make sure you give to God what is duly God's. As long as you're doing that, you can pay all the taxes you want. So notice what a huge difference it makes, though, that the question that Paul and Jesus both are answering is not, can I ever disobey the government? That's not the question. The question is, can I ever obey the government? To which Jesus and Paul are saying, yeah, you can. But can I ever disobey the government? Both of them would say, duh. Yeah, if they ask you not to serve God, or if they ask you to violate that which God is requiring of you, of course you can. There the paradigm case is, I think Ron mentioned it, when Peter goes before the Sanhedrin commands him to not claim Jesus any longer, to shut up about Jesus. And Peter's response is, well, yeah, okay. Well, whether it's right for me to obey God or to obey you, I guess I'll let you decide that. But as for me, I kind of answered that question. I need to obey God. And that would be so taken for granted by any of these people that of course you have to obey God, that of course you will disobey the government sometimes. That's a given. But is it ever right to actually obey them? To which Paul and Jesus are saying, yeah, keep it in perspective. Recognize that God is bigger than they are. And however much they might be evil and immoral and godless and hubristic in their arrogant pride to think that they are gods themselves, however much that may be true, they wouldn't even be there if God didn't put them there. So you're not disrespecting God and being unholy to accept that fact and pay your taxes. And then finally, the passage from Luke. I just think there are a couple of things that are interesting there. It starts from the statement, they're having a dispute about which of them is greatest, which of the disciples of Jesus is the greatest apostle of Jesus. And the main point of that passage is to completely radically reorient his disciples. Why on earth are you even thinking in those terms, he's saying. And this is a really, really difficult teaching, because basically what he's saying is you shouldn't even be thinking in terms of your standing and your status in the eyes of other people. Jesus is the greatest man in the whole history of the whole creation. And how did he conduct himself? He came to serve, not to make a name for himself. He came to serve, not to be honored. He came to serve, not to have other people praise him and give him glory. And that example of Jesus is used several times in the New Testament in that regard. And so he's just saying the same thing to them here. You guys are thinking like Gentiles. The Gentile leaders, they lorded over the people, and they like to be called benefactors. But it shouldn't be that way among you. You should be, following my example, you should be more like the servant waiting on the table rather than the honored guest reclining at the table. Think of yourself as here to serve, not here to be glorified and honored. You should become like children. And I think what he means there is a social comment. It's not a psycho-emotional comment about the state of children. It's a social comment. Children were invisible in that society. They didn't even count. And so what he's saying is to become like a child is to become of no account. You should become someone who's willing to be utterly trivial in the eyes of other people. Be substantive in the love and service that you give to other people, but be invisible in the social standing that you try to achieve for yourself. Well, what is interesting about that passage for our purposes here is this thing about the Gentiles, the Gentile kings who lorded over them and liked to be called benefactors. What's striking is that name benefactors to me. It seems to me that the natural tendency of ignorant Gentile human government, the natural tendency is going to be people who want to be benefited, and groups and people who rise to the top who are arrogant, proud people who have a lust to be able to be seen as benefactors, or to use a different word, to be gods. The natural tendency of human beings, I think, is to create governments where we create people who pretend to be gods, and then we are people who pretend to be taken care of by those gods. And we create incredibly unrealistic expectations from our gods. Our gods should be able to control the weather, control nature, provide for every need, take all risk out of life, take away all danger, take away all sickness and hunger. They should be able to do everything. And if they don't, they're failed gods. Well, why did we think they could ever be gods to start with? And why would we want them to be gods? And even worse, why would anyone ever think they could be gods? And put themselves in that position. That's the foolish Gentile way of thinking about government. And I think that has radical implications for how we organize ourselves. Okay, those were the four passages that we were required. Open it up for questions.
Jack, I was just curious, in light of some of the ways that we interpreted Old Testament passages, Old Testament law that we're no longer under, would the same principle of interpreting those passages be able to be applied to, say, the passage in Acts about the Woodstock community? It seemed like you were kind of doing that when you said the enduring principle is generosity. Could you do the same thing and say the enduring principle is a willingness of the Christian community to be cooperative and sacrifice some of their goods for the sake of others? Or how far can you go with interpreting?
Would you distinguish that from generosity? Are you making a distinction between?
Yeah, I think in terms of, like, not saying that that's necessarily not generous, but how far can you go in your interpretive principle of, let's look into this passage and see what principle we can pull out of it? Can you go to the point of saying perhaps it means we need to, in general, consider simplifying our material needs or cooperating more in order to be more generous, not necessarily adopt the form of the people of that period, but is the interpretive principle that's used in the Old Testament applied accurately to that passage to go that far?
If I'm understanding the question, I don't think so. I don't think you can go that far. Not, you might be able to defend that premise on other grounds, but I don't think you could from Acts 2. And the point being, once we've put it in its historical context and understand how utterly human it would be to be faced with those problems and solve the problems in the way that they solve them, it makes it very clear how highly contextual their behavior is. It's on that occasion that that behavior makes sense. When they go back home, are they going to be able to reproduce and recreate their experience they had there back home? No, not a chance. For all kinds of reasons, including none of the apostles came with them. That was just such an unusual, rare, remarkable event that they all got to experience. I mean, it would have been wonderful to be there. But there's no way that that's ever going to be replicated anywhere.
Could that period be considered a temporary emulation of the future kingdom?
Well, it could be, but I doubt it. And the reason I doubt it is because they're working with built-in restraints. That's not a self-sustaining community. The vast majority of the people there are probably not able, in that context, to be productive, contributing members of it. There's only so many fields that the native believers own. Once they've liquidated those and used all that, now what are they going to do? So it's sort of built in to be, has obsolescence as an experience built into it. And I think the kingdom of God being eternal is going to be an entirely different experience.
I'm still trying to think about how you said, so I got your point about the Acts, the Pentecost being unique, and then you were saying that wasn't how Jesus and the disciples lived, or maybe the other Jewish people up to Pentecost, and yet, would you say that Jesus and his disciples, including the women who traveled, and I'm thinking like of Joanna who left, I'm assuming she left her husband, or maybe she and her husband came from Herod's court, and these women who had been healed supported Jesus and their disciples out of their own means. Would you say that, well, I'm looking like at Luke 8 when they're going on that tour throughout, just the first few verses of Luke 8, it mentions them, and it makes, or some other times I'm thinking of where the disciples went out with just certain supplies and not very much, and those times also seem unique to me.
I'm sorry?
They seem unique to me too, particular mm-hmm. to time and place mm-hmm. and situation. So I guess I'm not sure what you are referring to in contrast to Pentecost Woodstock. What was, you know what I'm trying to get at? What was the norm? Because every time I see Jesus with the disciples, when some of those fishermen just left their nets and followed, I'm guessing, even though they still, like Peter, still had a wife and a mother-in-law and all that. But what was the norm then?
Well, of course, the time of Jesus' ministry was also one of those rather unique events. It doesn't appear, I think you have evidence, if you look closely, read the Gospels closely, there have to be times where they would travel with Jesus, then they would go back home, mm-hmm. then they'd pick up and travel with Jesus again and then go back home. So it wasn't like for 3 or 4 years they didn't see their family and they weren't home. It's just that those weren't worth recording in the Gospels. So those time spans didn't make it into the account. What I'm thinking of is like when Paul is in Corinth in the book of Acts, he's working at his trade alongside two other believers, Aquila
and Priscilla. When he's the tent maker, you mean, or when he's preaching?
Tent maker, if that's what his trade was, there's some debate. He's some kind of leather worker. There's some debate about exactly what was his trade. What does that
mean? While he was on his missionary journeys, you're saying he had another trade.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, so in Corinth, for example, we know that he's working alongside Priscilla and Aquila, who have the same trade. They make their product, they sell it in the marketplace, they have a normal, everyday Corinthian kind of life. Well, not a Corinthian kind of life. They have a normal, everyday Jewish kind of alien life in Corinth. But he teaches regularly. And like in Corinth, he started off in the synagogue. He got kicked out of the synagogue and moved to the school of Tyrannaeus or whatever it is. And he spent years in that kind of lifestyle. No hint whatsoever of setting up a commune or living community or communally or anything of the sort when he was in Corinth. They were getting on with ordinary life now and were teaching, proclaiming the gospel, exhorting one another, and ministering to one another in the context of everyday ordinary life now. It's no longer an unusual experience. Is that?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is there's a lot of everyday ordinary life that happened between these unusual
exactly.
journeys.
Exactly.
Things.
This is for either Charlie or Chris. Reading the Marx document on, or the Engels, I guess, on Tuesday, the more I've thought about how he uses Darwin, and the more he describes, he kind of uses nature as his proof for the economy, the way he's looking at it. Normally, and I'm critical of it because he uses the Darwin model to help pull the metaphysical out of the forces in the world. But there's something kind of brilliant about it, that he's looking at ecology and the way the environment works, and he's deducing this the way humanity works in their own economy. And I just didn't know, Charlie, I've heard you talk a little bit about it, and Chris, we talked a little bit. I didn't know if either of you had anything to say. I just think it's actually really a brilliant way to look at our actual financial economy by kind of, anyway, does that make sense?
While you're thinking, can I tell you something Charlie told me?
Yeah.
It's only tangential to what you're saying, but Charlie was telling me this morning, this really makes a lot of sense to me, that he mentioned in his lecture the comparison between economics and ecology. And think about how remarkable it is in ecology that you have independent organisms, none of which are consulting one another about their behaviors, nor is it centrally controlled by some prime organism in the ecostructure. Every organism is functioning as an isolated individual, following its instincts and eating what it eats and mating with what it mates with and stuff like that, is doing its own thing as an individual. And yet, every ecologist would marvel at the, you called it the invisible hand, that brings incredible balance and harmony in that thing. Mm-hmm. And that, I'll let you take it from here, but that's what Adam Smith was marveling at, is that however miraculous and remarkable might seem, isn't it interesting that even though each individual is acting like an individual, isn't there something that's bringing some kind of harmony to this?
Well, actually, I'm not sure what to add. But again, even in the Bible, we see references to how things work in nature is something to look at for us to think about with regards to issues like economy or living.
That's exactly what I was... I just kind of wanted to give, I was thinking of Marx almost deserves a little more, some credit for, like, maybe it wasn't, you're using Adam Smith, and that makes more sense to me, but the way Marx kind of was looking at Darwin and what was going on, and anyway, I just thought it was actually kind of a brilliant way that he kind of used it as a proof for what he was saying, although I think he drew completely inaccurate conclusions. So I have another question, Charlie. Have you ever thought, put much thought into what a slow growth economy would look like?
Not slow growth specifically, but I would say the closest that I have come to looking at that would be Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, Moderate Technology. So in other words, the title of his book was Small is Beautiful, Economics as a People Mattered, because the issue he's raising is the economic system subservient to people, or has it subsumed primary, and now we're subservient to this economic system? So that's the closest context, but slow growth itself, I have not really looked at that.
I just wanted to note real quick, I thought about that too with the Marx and nature, and kind of looking at that and being like, wow, this is really brilliant, because nature is a force that's really wild, and he's kind of saying, you know, so is the economy. It's something that can be predicted, how Darwin was grabbing hold of nature and looking at things scientifically and saying, okay, we can actually grab this. But the thing that I get stuck on is with humanity, there's morality and there's things that are different from science. So that's where it gets messed up.
But the point Charlie made for me, I should let him speak for himself. It depends on how you look at nature. If you look at it as a Darwinian, you see nature as wild and out of control, the way a socialist looks at the economy. If you look at nature as a theist, what you are struck with is that it's not wild and out of control. It's orderly, it's structured, it's harmonious, it works. It appears to be designed.
Well, this is backing up a little bit, I think, more to what we were talking more at the beginning of the week. But Charlie and I were talking about something yesterday at lunch that I thought maybe you guys would like to comment on or expand on. We were just talking about how, like, with some of these economists, especially Adam Smith, their goal was to reduce the amount of work that we have to do and increase the amount of stuff that we get. And I'm looking at our culture, like my generation now, who's grown up without very much work, and a lot of stuff, and we're really kind of apathetic. We feel worthless. Life seems pointless. And it's just kind of interesting to see kind of our perspective on it now. I don't know if you guys want to talk about that at all.
Well, part of that conversation we were having is it came out of a conversation a little bit about Schumacher, because in part that's what he was questioning, essentially the foundational assumptions of all of economics. Does it make sense if you're a Christian to say our definition of work is something that's to be avoided? Is that a Christian view of work? Full economy, that means we have 6% unemployment because we need people to be able to move so this economy can make changes and improve. So if you're one of those 6%, the question is, what is the value of a human being in that system? And so one of the things he was raising was, what would it actually look like to start out with Christian sort of principles and ask the question, now what would our Christian model of economy look like? He argued it would be quite different in many respects from the systems that virtually any of these people that we've read at this point would generate. So he was encouraging us to go back and build a totally different model actually built on Christian principles and see what that would look like.
I'm still struck after this whole, how far we've gone this week, with the statement biblically where God declares, I make the rich, I make the poor, I make the great, and I make the small. And he is claiming, I create inequity. Now, I'm not saying that poor means miserably poor or even starving poor, and we have a clear admonition to help the helpless and to relieve the sufferings of the poor. Is my knee-jerk response to any system that we've read about that strives to create equity is just basically ungodly. I want to say, who do you think you are? That inequity is not wrong. Is it doomed to failure because of that?
Yeah, I think it is. I'll deal with this in my paper tomorrow. I think it's fundamentally unbiblical to think in terms of bringing sameness among human beings, because God obviously is not committed to that. We talk about, I think it came up in one of our groups, about what do you do with the person who's always complaining about how unfair it is that the boss makes so much money and I have so little. Well, turn your gaze to other areas of life. It's so unfair that all of you are so much better looking than I am. It's so unfair that you're so much more intelligent than I am. It's so unfair that some people are 3/4 of the way to the basket already and I can't even reach it. You know, it's just unfair. But we wouldn't even dream of doing anything about that because, of course, it's not within our power to change that. But your point is, but doesn't that tell us how God does things? Isn't that the reality of our lives?
Yeah, in Keynes, I'd like to know if you could explain. In the reading, it said there were two problems with the current economic system. One was lack of full employment. The other was, he said, inequitable and arbitrary distribution of wealth. And yet, further on in the paper, Keynes says that it's okay to have disparity in wealth if it's limited. But he's objecting to something there. And I didn't really understand what this inequitable and arbitrary was in the...
I don't know for sure, but my best guess, given that book and some other things he said, it's this. After World War I, and remember, he ran the economy of England in World War I, he predicted that they would go into a recession. Roughly 25% of the population of England was unemployed for more than 10 years. So in a period from 1922 to 1936, there was only 1 year it was less than 10%, which is roughly where we are. So he's looking at what he thinks is, and I would agree, is just a horrendous economic situation to be in, where 25% of your population has nothing for more than a decade. They're totally unemployed. And his point is, and this is one of his sort of criticisms against the free market, was what he's objecting to is, and it wasn't by choice. See, they want to work, but they got thrown out of work. And so that's what he means, I think, by the arbitrary situation that we're in. It isn't any fault of theirs. They were trying to make good decisions, and they wanted to work. So my best guess is that's what he means by that.
I think that in addition to what Charlie said, which is I think is exactly right, reading sort of Hayek's history of socialism and the rise of socialism and the importance of socialism in, as a movement in Europe at that time, that my suspicion is that one of the things, and I'm not sure about this, but one of the things that Keynes is addressing is, okay, we've got this horrible situation. Socialism is pressing down pretty hard and becoming extremely popular. And I suspect that Keynes is kind of committed to more of a free market kind of economy. He would rather have something where people can do what they want. However, he's not completely uninfluenced by socialism. And he recognizes the inequality that has existed. And the reason why, one of the reasons why socialism is around and why Marx is complaining so bad was because there were these capitalists and industrialists who had a whole lot of money, and there was this poor labor force which was subjected to all kinds of horrible experiences. So even before the recession, there was this long history in England of the kind of thing that Charles Dickens would write about, where you got the rich guy and he's abusing the poor people or something like that. So socialism was popular partly because of the abuses of the capitalistic system, and so if Keynes is going to have any traction at all in society, he's going to necessarily, it seems to me, have to address the fact that, yes, there is this inequality of wealth, and partly by the recession, partly because of the background that we've come in, and we need to address that. And I may be a free market person, but let's be serious, people. This is outrageous, this inequality of wealth. We need to do something about that. So I think that that was something that was behind the scenes. And if we don't do anything about that, then potentially there's the danger of a socialist revolution, and then you lose everything.
Maybe I have a misperception about what was going on in the first century, right between the crucifixion and Pentecost, but I guess I thought that the disciples were actually pretty scared, questioning, kind of huddled together, trying to figure this thing out, and hanging out with each other. And that doesn't fit the picture that you were talking about earlier, about how so many people were staying in Jerusalem, not just because of the crucifixion, but it implied to me that there was all this other stuff going on afterwards that was keeping them there. So I guess I have a misunderstanding.
What I was describing in Acts 2 is subsequent to Pentecost.
Right. But didn't you say that people... Okay, so the event, the miraculous event you were talking about was not necessarily the crucifixion, but...
No, not at all.
Okay, so...
No, you have the crucifixion... Okay. Followed by the resurrection.
Yeah.
The disciples actually go back to Galilee because
right.
Jesus instructed them to.
Okay.
And he appears to them in Jerusalem before they go. He appears to them again in Galilee when they're up there. And then he instructs them, I want you to go back so many days before Pentecost to Jerusalem. So they go back a few days before Pentecost. And yes, they're just hanging out, waiting expectantly for whatever it is that Jesus says that they're waiting for. And then Pentecost happens.
Okay.
And Pentecost is this remarkable event.
Yeah.
At Pentecost and the wake of Pentecost is a remarkable event where the Holy Spirit, God has pulled out all the stops and has invaded the hearts of scores of people, turning their whole lives upside down and marking the fact that it's the work of God through these miraculous things that the apostles are doing at the same time. That's what they're hanging out for.
Okay. So, yeah, I guess... As a Christian, I kind of smushed everything together, and I didn't quite realize this. So basically, there's lots of people gathered together in Jerusalem for Passover, and God...
Pentecost.
I'm talking about crucifixion.
Okay,
crucifixion. Yeah. So God brings all these people together for Passover and does the Jesus thing, and then people disperse.
Yeah, they've gone home.
Okay, and then more people, different people maybe, come
exactly.
for the Feast of Booths.
Pentecost, which...
But I mean, the Jewish pilgrimage is for the Feast of Booths. That's why they're there, right?
Well, are Pentecost and Feast of Booths the same one?
Well, no. Well, I mean, Pentecost happens, but the reason why all
no,
these...
No, Pentecost is a Jewish festival. I can't remember if it's another name for the Feast of Booths or whether
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
How
no, it is.
How can I not know all
it
this
is.
Stuff?
It's the Feast of Booths, yeah.
Okay, so you have all of these foreign people gathering for yet a different event... Feast of Booths, and then God uses a second opportunity. Okay, that makes much more sense. Thank you.
This is in relation to that same issue. You said that the law at the time stipulated they had to attend all the festivals. they had to come back to Jerusalem. At what point?
Every year.
Oh, okay. So at what point did it change from every year to once in a lifetime? When did that change?
Probably in Babylon. When they were in Babylon, everything had to be rethought by the rabbis in Babylon. And
what year was that? Can you give me a date?
Somebody who knows dates.
790s? The 70s?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
This has been a helpful week so far for me in that I've identified, made some connections between the two sides, at least initially, the left and the right, and those are charged words, I know, but tend to be a left-leaning and a more conservative-leaning way of attacking things, way of approaching things, and what's at stake, what tends to be at stake for each side, or what's different about them. It's not just necessarily just a matter of a different approach wanting to get the same thing. There's something fundamentally. That was what I was wondering, is what's at the core, what's motivating them, why does this discussion matter? And I think for the first time I've heard this idea that it's that being poor, not having a lot, is not wrong. I don't think I've ever really considered that before, but that it makes sense. And that's a very, from the world that I come from, my family and things, that's a very, I think that would be a very controversial thing to say. It would be very insulting. And it just struck me, I just made the connection in my mind, just wanted to get your reaction to it, that I've had a similar reaction to abortion. You know, one of the arguments is to legalizing it is it will, you know, we need to reduce the amount of abortions that are happening. We need, by making them safer or reducing the back alley ones that where teenagers are at risk for dying or whatever. And I came to the point where I decided, well, it might be that there will be more back alley deaths of teenagers, and that will be better because there's a deeper principle at stake in us. It would be better than us granting approval to the institution of abortion because of what that will do to our souls and that, again, that's that same kind of, how can you say that it's okay, that you're okay with young teenage mothers dying in back alleys? How can you say that? To me, that's where the values really come out between the two camps. And I just wanted to make that comment that that's kind of something I'm starting to see in the economic models as well, that not having a lot of money, being poor, having hardship isn't a wrong thing. And you just comment on the relation, if there's a connection between those whole abortion discussion and that.
Yeah, I think what they share in common, to say the same thing I think that you were saying another way, is I think you see it most clearly in Hayek. The people who defend the kind of free market individualism that Hayek is defending are doing so not really primarily on economic grounds, but on moral grounds. And so it's really important to see that the issue for them is not, is this the best way to get stuff for the right people? It's a question of what does it mean to be a human being, and what's the right way to structure life so that human beings can thrive as human beings, where it's their soul, and I don't mean their spirit, I'm not talking biblically, but their humanity is actually far more important than their pocketbook, their banking account. So that is fundamentally different perspective than socialism. I would argue that socialism is significantly more materialistic than capitalism is, which seems ironic, but philosophically, that's exactly true. That, as you pointed out, really, it's okay to leave someone with less money than I have? I mean, that's okay. Who would think otherwise except a materialist? To be lacking materially is the worst of all possible evils because that's all there is. Well, the capitalist thinks that's not all there is. There's much more to humanity than just how much money you have. Therefore, the idea that somebody could be in poverty and their soul could be full makes sense to someone like Hayek. It doesn't make sense to a Marx or an Engels.
Although there are plenty of capitalists who are purely materialistic as well.
So the analogy with abortion is that, I'll talk about this tomorrow in my paper, but the other thing is that we grow up in a culture that judges the rightness or wrongness of an action by the consequences. I don't think that's biblical. Sometimes the consequences can be horrendous, even though it's the right thing to do. So even if taking a stand in defense of unborn children leads to some sort of horrendous consequences for some people, okay, what's new? I mean, all of life can lead to horrendous consequences for one person or another. That's just the way life is. So you don't decide what are the consequences. You don't discount the consequences, but that doesn't exhaustively determine the difference between right and wrong. So you have to determine, based on some kind of principled decision, what's the right thing here, and go with what's right, and face the consequences as they come.
I was just going to add one other thing that I don't think has been explicitly articulated, and that is one of the things that's happened here is when we think of justice now, we think it means equality. And so, for example, even back up to something like Declaration of Independence and what the Founding Fathers would have said, well, we're all created equal. Equal in what sense? Do we all have equal mental abilities? Do we all have this? Of course they didn't mean that. They just meant we have sort of equal opportunities. It's not we're going to equally come up with all the same political power or political whatever. And for them, they weren't concerned about the economic side of this at all. They weren't concerned about that we're all created equal, meaning that in a just world we'd all have exactly the same materially. That wasn't the point of view in Adam Smith's time. By the time of Marx, we see it is, but I don't know all the people that were involved in that transformation. But that's one of the core pieces here, I think, that becomes a foundational piece for the socialists. And it's accepted virtually unquestioned by most of our culture that, well, of course, justice means equality.
There's also one other distinction to be made. I'm agreeing with everything you guys are saying. I think there's a confusion that happens between a desire for equality and a compassion for people who are disadvantaged and suffering. And I think those two things sometimes get equated with each other, that to have compassion and concern for people who are poor and suffering or have disadvantages or something like that, that a lot of times people will say, if you have that kind of compassion, then you necessarily must come on board with me and attempt to solve all those problems through these particular means. And the problem that I have is that sometimes those means are rejecting the potential for people to have freedom in their own lives. So if the means are saying, we who are the majority are going to impose upon you, the minority, that you have to come alongside of us and participate with us in helping these poor disadvantaged people, that seems to me different than purely just having compassion and concern for the poor. Compassion and concern for the poor can be, we can act individually out of generosity to help those people, but to have a system that forces us to do what maybe we don't have in our heart to do, or we're doing something else, or I don't know, there's all kinds of different possible scenarios. Those seem to be slightly different things, and they can get confused. And I think capitalists have been criticized, and sometimes fairly, and sometimes unfairly, for having no compassion or concern for the poor.
Another thing that a while ago I asked David Crabtree a question, I don't even remember what the question was, but his answer involved saying that he thought, I may be butchering this a little bit, one of the opportunities God gives us in creating poor people and people with disadvantages is so that for our sake that we can show love to them, for their sake obviously, but also for our own sake, and that really if you have socialism where, or anything where it's sort of an automatic, mechanical thing whereby money and material wealth is filtered equally to everyone, or to the poor especially, no one is any longer showing any compassion, really. So even if your motive was compassion, that I wish their circumstances were better, I wish the poor's circumstances were better, you've removed the element of personally showing them love from the equation completely. And then after a couple generations, by the time everyone takes it for granted, any advantage will be totally gone because it's just taken for granted that, well, by this political and government machine, we just have everything equally.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And you've removed all the soul-searching that has to go with that, which is the most spiritually productive thing we do. Confront the reality. Why am I such a selfish bastard? That's significant. That's where spiritual growth really happens.
And it seems like just as much as this desire for justice and this notion of equality, there's also this, what gets smuggled in are these things that we call virtues now, which is predictability, security, and what looks like or what we hope to be no longer messy lives. And really, what the truth of the matter is, if we let people have the freedom and the opportunity to have to struggle through, that presents a whole level of messiness that makes us really uncomfortable. and that we try desperately, I think, to get rid of. So,
amen.
At the risk of repeating something maybe already has been said, I think when, as you said, Jack, that you shift over to focusing on consequences and we focus solely on the consequences, then what you just said, Dan, was kind of a direct follow implication of that way of looking at life. And so the things that I immediately think of are, as individuals, you know, we look at how inefficient it is for me to express compassion and to have to worry, really, that's what it comes to, have to worry about doing my part to show it in many, many different situations. And isn't it so much more efficient and easier to be part of a collective that has that responsibility or exemplifies that? And whether that's as Christians in ministry, we're going to be more effective by hiring a pastor and staff to take care of all those things for us, so that, frankly, it's just, even if the consequences were the same, on the whole, I don't have to be bothered by having to worry about all these other things. I can specialize in my little chunk of the universe.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Not only I don't have to worry about it, I don't have to feel uncomfortable in seeing the reality, for example, of poverty or something like that. You know, it's kind of, would you make it go away for me, government? Make it go away so I don't have to be uncomfortable. I think that's often the motive.
I heard a story a few years ago that has stuck with me, and it's about Mother Teresa, who founded a mission in Calcutta, as most of us know. But a few years later, she was visiting in New York and said that she was going to found a mission there as well. And her reason, when somebody asked her, was that she felt that the people in New York were more impoverished than the people in Calcutta. And so that stayed with me. And I guess one question I have is, as we're thinking about economic systems that move towards the material comfort, the material economic good for as many people as possible, I feel like that's, there's something spiritually dangerous in that. And I know that people have said this in a lot of different ways already, but how do we know when suffering is not spiritually edifying? And how do we know when suffering is spiritually edifying? And so isn't there something a little bit hubristic about interfering? It's so complicated, but I don't know if you guys have anything to say about that.
Well, I think it's ever right to withhold my aid and my help and my comfort because I think it's good for you. That is hubristic. I'm not God. I'm just a fellow human being. And what need should call out of me is the compassion to reach out to meet that need. And I just think that's what loving your neighbor is. We should always, always do that. Never hesitate to do that. Now, not that every need, one of the most helpful things a mentor of mine early on told me was, put in a slogan form, a need does not constitute a calling. Just because someone has a need doesn't mean God is calling me to meet that need. And that was a lifesaver at the time because I lived in a group of people who was basically taking in every little Jesus freak hippie coming down the street to minister to them, and we were literally exhausting ourselves. We didn't have the resources to meet it. And that's when he said, just because someone is in need doesn't mean you are the one that God is calling to meet that need. So we have to keep that in perspective and keep that in balance. But every need is potentially a calling for me. I can never rationalize it by saying, well, God's put him in that condition, so he must be teaching them something, and I wouldn't want to interfere with what God wants to teach them. I don't think that's ever the right way to think about it. But is that what God is doing? Absolutely. Everyone suffering is potentially, is spiritually advantageous one way or the other. God is either wooing them to himself, strengthening their faith, he's getting their attention to bring them into better relationship with himself. I have no question about that. But I'm not going to interfere with God in that regard. If I alleviate their suffering, I'm not messing up sanctification in their life.
It's the bond of sound. That is why people point fingers at Christians and say, you bastard. Selfish, laissez-faire, capitalist Christians.
What is that?
The possibility we raise that this person is not my responsibility. Oh. And I was... I remember reading this story somewhere about this guy that was born blind, and he lived that way all his life until this Jesus guy walked up and said, God did this for my glory. And I just thought, you get into the, if you play the role of that poor blind kid who can't play with his friends, you know, couldn't learn a trade, and it's just like, how horrible. And then one day Jesus walks up and says, you can see now. And he didn't jump up and go, well, it's about bloody time. his reaction is that, well, what about all those fun times as a kid I didn't get? And what about, and on and on and on. So his view of suffering is that, you mean I got to suffer so you could reveal yourself to the people? That's a fair trade. I don't have that kind of heart. I'm the guy that jumps up and says, well, what about my back pay? What about some reparations here? You know, why? Come on, let's sweeten the pot. I'm not that sweet. I'm not that faithful. And I think what you said about every helpless person, I would make the distinction between the helpless and needy and the stupid and needy. Because, I mean, I had a friend who drank himself under a bridge, okay? He loved his alcohol more than he loved his wife or his child or his job. And he ended up living under a bridge. It's hard for me to have compassion for that man. But in his defense, last time I saw him a few years ago, he was still sober and still working, helping other people get sober. Marriage was a little rocky. But his process, looking at himself and saying, I'm living under a bridge, broke his heart. I wonder sometimes if we don't over-compassion ourselves to where we interfere with that, and sometimes we under-compassion ourselves to where we're just afraid that we'll be taken advantage of, or maybe that finger they're pointing at us, in my case, may be true. Maybe I am just fearful and selfish, but I'm just glad to hear people willing to not be on one side or the other so dogmatically. It's refreshing.